Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Brenda Williams-Butts, and I'm the Senior Director of Community Engagement at WNYC Radio. I want to thank the Brooklyn Museum for hosting this event for us tonight, and especially Sally Williams. A couple of housekeeping things. Please keep your cell phones on, but silence them. We also would like to be social tonight, so tweet with us at hashtag BrooklynBound. I'm here to introduce your host for this evening, and her name is Mythalie Rao. Mythalie is a producer and book critic at WNYC. She currently oversees planning and production of the Takeaways daily editorial content, working to bring diverse and authentic voices to the show's daily coverage and national and international news. Before joining WNYC, she worked for CNN's New York Bureau, where she field produced and filled and filed breaking news stories. Mythalie is also a contributing writer for the Daily Beast, and her reporting and criticisms have additionally appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, The Nation, and Words Without Borders, among others. Please make sure to stop at the museum store, which is right over here in the left corner. They stay open until 10 p.m., and all the authors' books will be available there. Please help me in welcoming Mythalie.
Good evening, and thank you so much for coming tonight. I'm thrilled to be representing WNYC in the station's first Brooklyn Book Festival event. And we're delighted to be here live at the Brooklyn Museum tonight. And it's wonderful to share the stage with such talented writers, all of whom's work so sharply explores life in Brooklyn in all its splendor and contradiction. I want to start with an informal poll. How many of you are from Brooklyn? How many of you live in Brooklyn? Pretty good. The Bronx, Staten Island, Manhattan, Queens, and how many of you are writers yourselves? We'll be opening up the question. We'll be opening up the discussion a little later to audience questions. So I look forward to hearing from the Brooklynites among you, and the non-Brooklynites, and the non-Brooklyn non-writers. So start thinking about what you want to ask our wonderful panel tonight. The idea of Brooklyn as a literary hub is nothing new. And while preparing for this event, I had the pleasure of spending a lot of time in WNYC's archives, listening to old interviews of various writers who through the years have come in and out of the station, everyone from Marianne Moore to William Styron. And I want to start tonight with some comments from poet and playwright Norman Rosten. He was a friend of Arthur Miller's and, according to his New York Times obituary, the poet laureate of Brooklyn. In 1968, he was part of a conversation about writing in New York that was broadcast by WNYC. And here's what he says about living in New York and about taking inspiration from the city and from Brooklyn in particular.
When you're trapped in New York, when you begin from Coney Island, which is part of New York, and work your way up into Brooklyn, and you're getting closer to New York, you're still in New York. You don't fight to escape it. After a while, you fight to absorb it. You want to absorb it. It's around you, and you find out that where you live is, in a way, an accident. And you let the city, if it is a city, accrete around you, and you use it. After all, wherever we live, we use our environment, and we use our life. And living in the city is a very manifold environment. There are just fantastic amount of things going on. And if you can stay awake long enough, you could take a lot of them in. So it's exciting and fortunate. Of course, if you're in Chicago or possibly Los Angeles or New Orleans, I suppose you also have a city to contend with. It's our theory. I hope it's mine that New York has some special quality for the poets that live within it.
It's Norman Rostin there speaking. I hope you could hear that. I know his voice is kind of creaky and old in this in the acoustics of this room, too. But I really love that idea of letting the city accrete around you, that it's something that you just have to soak in and not fight. And it's certainly the case that Brooklyn has soaked deep into the works of all of our writers here tonight. Our first panelist, Evan Hughes, is the author of Literary Brooklyn. It's a fantastic, very comprehensive history of the lives and works of writers who've lived and taken inspiration from the borough, from Walt Whitman to Jonathan Lethem. And he writes, and this is another important note to start on, there is no Brooklyn School of Literature, and there never has been. But in reading his book, I was really pleased to discover some clear commonalities in how working and living in Brooklyn and the idea of Brooklyn has inspired so many writers. To start with the obvious, for one, they're all aware of being at a remove from Manhattan's bustle, from Manhattan's self-importance. There's an outsider status built into their work. Poet Hart Crane, who is himself a famous Brooklynite, put it this way. He says, "It's particularly fine to feel the greatest city in the world from enough distance as I do here to see its larger proportions. When you're actually in it, you're too often distracted to realize its better and more imposing aspects." And being farther from the heart of the greatest city not only means being better able to appreciate it, it also means being closer to the heart of the common man. And whether it's Henry Miller romanticizing his childhood on the rough streets, or Paul Auster imagining the life of Brooklyn orphans, a Brooklyn education, Evan writes, has really offered a lot of writers the chance to think about what it means to be close to the normal working class, striving immigrant, whoever it might be. And Evan, I hope you'd start off by reading a passage from Thomas Wolfe, and maybe you can explain a little bit this particular moment and this particular idea of being close to the ordinary man.
Sure, yeah. I think this is a big part of Wolfe's identity, is that in many ways, we're talking about, by the way, not Tom Wolfe with the white suits, but Thomas Wolfe from the 1930s who wrote You Can't Go Home Again, and several other gigantic novels. It was a big part of his identity that he wasn't fancy, and he kind of lived this writerly existence of looking like a slob and writing on the top of his refrigerator and being kind of monstrous to people around him. But he liked it that way, and he liked Brooklyn's. That somehow put him in touch with that side of his identity. So that's what this passage is about. It's really short. Young men were writing manifestos in the higher magazines of Manhattan, but the weather of man's life, the substance and structure of the world in which he lives, was soaking in on me in those years in Brooklyn, in those countless days and hours spent in my room, above my table, looking out the window, walking the endless jungle of the streets, talking to men all night in all-night coffee shops, in subways, along the waterfront, upon the bridges, in South Brooklyn, upon trains.
Reminded me also of another observation in your book that Arthur Miller makes. He says that living in Brooklyn gave him a real sense of the man who's the backbone of the country. And we can get to that more later, but I want to now introduce our next panelist, Jason Reynolds. And as students of urban planning know, some of the biggest changes for Brooklyn in recent history took place in the 1970s. That's when the borough lost 14% of its population and a third of its white residents. As real estate prices plummeted, the character of Brooklyn changed, and neighborhoods changed in particular. The lingering fallout from those changes is a prominent feature in young adult novelist Jason Reynolds' novel, When I Was the Greatest, which is set in Bed-Stuy. And when Richard Wright moved to Bed-Stuy in 1938, it was just 3 years after the A-train had started running to that neighborhood, making it a very desirable home for blacks, for immigrants from all over the world. But by contrast, the Bed-Stuy in Reynolds' contemporary novel is on the cusp of a number of changes, and Ali, who's a 15-year-old narrator of When I Was the Greatest, lives with his family in what his mother calls the interesting part of Bed-Stuy, and interesting is her euphemism for saying they live in the poor, struggling part of the neighborhood. It's a block that white gentrifiers haven't discovered yet. And when the elderly couple who lives next door to Ali's family moves to Florida, the house falls into disrepair and is overrun with prostitutes and crackheads. But still, the block is safe enough for Ali and his families and his friends and neighbors to hang out. And he spends a lot of time sitting on his stoop with his two best friends, Roland and Ricky, or Noodles and Needles. And when they do run into trouble, it's actually on the unsafe part of the neighborhood. And Jason, I wanted you to read this passage where Ali describes his block as compared to the block where Maurice or Momo, who's the coolest kid in the neighborhood, lives, and where a party that they're looking forward to going to is.
All right. Tasha and Momo lived just a block down, but it seemed like a whole other borough just because the blocks were so much different. On one side of Decatur and Lewis, where we live, there's, well, where we live. A bunch of people like us, good folks with a little edge to them, as my mother puts it. Some trash on the sidewalk, or sometimes a pissy mattress or a stained-up couch. Brown bag beer bottles in the hands of old men and tattered-up teenagers, babies crying, an occasional fight, but also a lot of laughing. As a matter of fact, just a lot of noise in general. But on the other side of Decatur and Lewis, peace and quiet. Trees and flowers line the block. Every brownstone has a light post outside, so it's always well lit at night. No trash. It was the Cosby side of the street. I figured it must have been the part of the neighborhood where Doris was always talking about all the white people were moving into. Gotta be.
Thanks, Jason. So there you have it, the two sides of the block. And yet, by the end of the novel, you start to get the impression that maybe Ali's side of the block has a lot going for it. A lot of friendly folks, a lot of characters who check in on each other and who take care of each other. And that question of who or what makes and preserves the identity of a neighborhood and how that changes is also one that hovers over Marine Park Stories, which is the debut short story collection of Mark Chisano. And as the title promises, the physical geography of Marine Park plays a very big role in his very perceptive collection. There's the iconic Marine Park watering hole, Mariner's Inn. There's the park, which one of his characters says is the biggest park in the borough other than Prospect, if you count that, but who does? And then there are the main thoroughfares of Avenue R and Quinton Street. And one thing that comes up a lot in Mark's book is just how important these roadways are because the area is so underserved by public transportation. And a particularly great story called Air Conditioning features a father who runs a driving school, and his wife thinks it's terrifying that he was teaching the whole borough below Fulton Street to drive. She doesn't think he's a very good driver. But teaching driving seems like a very appropriate occupation for a faltering father figure in a part of the city that doesn't have a lot of buses or trains. The characters in Chisano's stories take living in Marine Park very seriously. It means you're a true Brooklynite. It means that you're happy with how far you are from the city proper. And it also means being perpetually attuned to the pull of the tides and shifts in weather. And Mark, I was hoping you'd read a scene about the weather bearing down on residents of Marine Park, catching them off guard.
That afternoon, there was a freak storm in the middle of the day. It hadn't smelled like rain. If you're from Marine Park, you can smell the weather coming in from the ocean before it breaks up against the hot swell of city air. Even still, it caught everyone by surprise. Amanda and Robert were sitting in folding chairs in their backyard, listening to a Rutgers game on the radio. Amanda knew that Robert didn't like basketball, but they listened to it anyway. The old man who lived on the end was on his deck, in a folding chair, ensconced in hanging vines. The breaker boy was on the roof, clutching a blue windbreaker that he didn't need yet, deciding whether to find the Ventrona girl. There wasn't much they could do. They could walk around the park. There was a place he knew, covered by weeping willows, where they could sit on the grass. but it was getting cold, though he didn't expect the rain. Point is, they were all outside when the storm came rolling in.
Great. That presence of the ocean also brings us to Yelena, because Yelena Akhtyrskaya's book, Panic in a Suitcase, is set in Brighton Beach, a neighborhood that also takes as one of its defining characteristics its proximity to the water. And Brighton Beach, in Yelena's book, is the home of the Nasmertov family, Jewish immigrants from Ukraine, who find in this particular patch of coastal Brooklyn something that's very familiar to them, and it reminds them of their home. So, Yelena, I was hoping you could read the passage on page 24, where they they talk about their affinity to the sea.
24. Got it. Okay, yeah, got it. 24.
Maybe like having been born and raised in the sea, that part?
Yes, okay. Having been born and raised by the sea, they hoped that an allegiance had been established. They hoped by asserting, by claiming to be a coastal breed. They were people of the margin. Is this okay? Okay. Of the edge of the land. If destiny wasn't mentioned, it was meant. Inland folk weren't expected to understand the distinction, just respect it. The particular body of water didn't matter. Coastal peoples from across the globe knew when they were among their kind. They dealt in axioms. They were spoiled for any other type of existence. The power of the ocean wasn't questioned. Aquatic mystery was steady stock, safe to invest in. Living by the ocean was like going to third grade with someone who went on to become world famous. The relationship became an integral part of one's identity. That the ocean never entered into the agreement was forgotten until a reminder was issued.
Perfect. Thanks. And I actually have one more passage for Yelena to read, because there's two traits here for Brighton Beach that really stuck out. One, the weather. And then two, just how much Little Odessa resembles Odessa. And that's something that comes up when the Nasmertov family gets a visitor from Ukraine, the eccentric Uncle Pasha, who's a poet. He's not yet decided if he's going to leave Ukraine and settle in New York for good, or if he wants to stay in his home country. And his preliminary impressions of the New World, and particularly of Little Odessa, leave him pretty unimpressed. It's on page. You want to read that from page 17?
The whole paragraph?
Where it starts, filth and dreariness.
Built?
Built.
Oh, okay. I got it. No worries. Filth, dreariness, and pigeon shit didn't bother him, but five gastronomes in a row called Odessa did. His fellow countrymen hadn't ventured bravely into a new land. They'd borrowed a tiny nook at the very rear of someone else's crumbling estate to make a tidy replication of the messy, imperfect original they'd gone through so many hurdles to escape, imprisoning themselves in their own lack of imagination, forgetting that the original had come about organically and proceeded to evolve, already markedly different from their poor quality photocopy. Such a bubble, no matter how enthusiastically blown, would begin to deflate in no time.
Great. I'm pleased to say there's no lack of imagination in Akhtyrskaya's work or in the work of any of the writers here tonight. Evan, Jason, Mark, Yelena, welcome. Thank you for being part of the conversation today. I think I have two main themes to talk about, to have you talk about. The first is geography, which is just the character of these neighborhoods and how the character of the neighborhood shapes the people in them who you write about. And the second is more about craft, what your process is like in using the neighborhood as a source of inspiration, but also not getting trapped in it or trapped by it. So I thought we could start. I mean, your passages all describe very nicely the neighborhood, but if you could, in your own words, talk a little bit about the neighborhoods that you write about. And Evan, in your case, it's really the question of what Brooklyn Heights, I think, in particular's legacy is, because so many writers are from there, and that was sort of where it all began.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to begin?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I think if you're sort of looking at the whole history of the whole literary history of Brooklyn, it's certainly like the greatest density of addresses where authors lived would be Brooklyn Heights. There's a whole map in my book just for, you know, they get at their own inset, Brooklyn Heights. You know, it wasn't for much of that time as Tony as it is now, but it was kind of, it was sometimes called America's first suburb. It was something, you know, you would live there, and, you know, when it first started, you would live there and commute to your job in finance, and that still happens. But when you, you know, there was, I mean, just one street, Columbia Heights in Brooklyn Heights, which parallels the promenade. It's really astounding how many writers lived there. And there was one building in particular that was, I think the landlord had turned it into a kind of writer's salon. I mean, not literally, not everybody lived together. They had their own apartments, but it was, you sort of applied to it. And that is where Hart Crane lived when he wrote about the Brooklyn Bridge, and he had the view right there of the Brooklyn Bridge. And as it happened, it was the same room that Roebling had lived in when he designed the bridge. This was a coincidence, and a great fortuitous one.
I think, well, I'll tell you this. Today I was walking, I was coming from the train, and I was, for anybody familiar with Bed-Stuy, there's, if you're coming off the A train, Fulton Park sits right outside the A train. And I'm walking through Fulton Park, and all the old guys are where they always are, which is sort of at the foot of the park, playing chess. And there's one guy who's always there with his car door open, blasting music. And so I walk through the park, and I get to the other side of the street, and there's a lady who's probably 70 years old trying to get in her house, but can't quite get in the house because she can't stop dancing to the music, right? And that's Bed-Stuy, right? I think they were playing, it was some 70s, like disco jam, you know, like, I don't know, Chic or something like that, right? So she's laughing so hard when I catch her. Like, I catch her, and I'm like, oh, look at you. And she's like laughing and continues dancing. I think that's sort of, that's Bed-Stuy, right? Like, anybody who's ever been to Bed-Stuy on a Saturday in the summertime knows what it's like to smell jerk chicken from the corner, knows what it's like to sort of hear the noise of the barbershops and the barbersol and the afro sheen sort of wafting through the air, knows what it's like to see the kids running around, acting crazy, the fire hydrants are open. The ice cream truck, the icy lady selling Coco Helado on the corner for $1. Everyone speaks just enough Spanish to make an order, right? Like that's sort of Bed-Stuy, which is why it's always fascinating to write about Bed-Stuy, because I have to write about it from what, like, in terms of what it is, as well as why I can't understand why everyone's so scared of it at the same time, right? How it's a magical place for me and a treacherous place for so many other people. And so a lot of the work when I'm sort of trying to nail down the setting of these books has a lot to do with that sort of dichotomy, right? This strange sort of duality of, like, I live here, and for me, this is a safe haven. But because people don't understand the codes and the charm, it seems as if it's a place that's undesirable, until recently, of course. But so that's sort of my take on that whole thing.
Well, with Brighton Beach, it's kind of different because I feel like everybody knows how desirable it is, you know? Everybody is just dying to move to Brighton Beach. They just haven't gotten around to it.
Including me.
Yeah. So I'm actually, I feel like it's my duty to tell everybody it's not as great as you all think it is. There are some problems there. Even though the food is delicious and the ocean is so beautiful and we're very close to Coney Island. Yeah.
Is the character of Brighton Beach today, do you think Pasha's assessment is right in how much Little Odessa is just like the real Odessa, and it's echoed in that way? Or is that a limitation of his imagination? What does it look like to you, I mean, as someone who grew up there?
Well, now it's changing, but it's always changing. You have to say every few years that it's changing, and you have to, you know, culturally stereotype and now say, well, like, all these people are coming in now, so it's not good anymore. Technically, though, I think that it's safe to say that, yeah, it is pretty much very similar to Odessa in Soviet times. That's the charm. But I would have to say, yeah.
I think, you know, what's funny is that the one major characteristic about Marine Park is probably that it's not changing, or it really hasn't changed in a long time. And if it does, it'll be a slow-moving tectonic plate. In the summer, lots of people bike to the beach now, which is also a recent thing in Brooklyn. But for some reason, I guess it's a Google Maps thing, the street that Google Maps tells you to bike, you know, on the way to Flatbush Avenue to go over the bridge to get to Rockaway is now 35th or 34th Street or something, and there's just hordes of fixed gears going through Marine Park, you know, on 30-something Street. And, you know, I haven't seen it, but I can imagine everyone from Marine Park going, what are these things? And I think that's sort of where I was kind of writing from, that it was this city from afar, or even like the rest of Brooklyn, that was changing and that was kind of on its way towards Marine Park. And Marine Park is kind of in this enclave that, you know, everyone is kind of biking through but not really noticing.
When did you notice growing up in Marine Park that you lived somewhere that was different from everywhere else in New York? I got the sense from the characters in your stories that there's a real Marine Park solidarity, and there's a real sense of we live in this little place that's our own little place and it's far away. When did you kind of have that realization living there?
I guess, I mean, hopefully it's something you grow out of, that just total solidarity towards your childhood neighborhood, but maybe not. I guess I probably, it kind of hit me when I went to high school in the city, and people didn't even know where Marine Park was or really thought of Brooklyn as somewhere very far away, really farther than just the bridges would explain. And then it kind of hit me that it takes, you know, an hour to get to Marine Park. This was nice. We actually did this in order of subway, like, distance from Manhattan.
It's true.
You know, this was good.
Wait, no, I'm farther.
No, I know, but you went last. So we kind of circled
originally?
Back.
Originally?
Yeah. The readers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that was intentional.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. That's great, though. And Yelena, when did you realize that you wanted to write about Brighton Beach? And I read a little bit of an interview of you saying you didn't want to, and you kind of found yourself coming at it backwards. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the last thing that I wanted to do was write about Brighton Beach, write about Russian people, write about my family. That was like, that was the only thing that had a giant X on it, you know? And then, of course, that's, you know, that was the jackpot in the end. It wasn't like outer space and Mars, which was originally the plan. I didn't want to write about it because it's like, it's so sore. It's a wound. I mean, you don't want, lately all I've been hearing is, well, you know, you're exposing all the ugliness of your neighborhood. You're exposing, how do all the Russian people feel about, you know, all the horrible things you're saying about them? And it's like, I don't think I'm saying horrible things. It's just the truth. No.
That doesn't go over very well, does it?
Yeah, so you don't want to write about the things that you are, like, all the gooey pain is in, which is Brighton Beach.
Well, can I just jump in?
Yes.
Well, I was just thinking about the writers in my book, and that you're sort of ahead of the game because there are a lot of writers who grew up in Brooklyn, in like immigrant communities, and it seems like to them it was the wound, but they couldn't write about it when they were young. Like, they wrote about it way down the road, and you know, that has its benefits, I'm sure, too. But but I think it was brave of you to go to the wound directly.
It's interesting, because there was nothing I wanted to write about more. Like, it's so weird, because I think I wrote a bunch of other novels, none of which ever got published. They were all very, very bad novels. And they really, really were. At the time, I didn't want to hear that, but now I'm like, oh, God, they were so bad. But so I wrote all these books about all these different things and all these different places, Bermuda and, like, you know, all these random, you know, stories. And then finally decided to write a story about the place that I had been living for all this time. And it was the easiest, most fun I had ever had as a writer. And I think possibly the reason why is because in Bed-Stuy, and in a lot of places in Brooklyn, I think, or in New York in general, I suppose, you can almost write anything and it be feasible, right? You can almost say anything happened and say in Brooklyn or in New York City, right? And they're like, oh, well, that's possible, right? It's like, oh, there's this guy, I saw this guy, he's standing on top of a car, it's like car surfing down the block, and people are like, I think I've seen that before. I'm pretty sure one time I saw this guy doing that, right? And I think that's what made it so much fun. You could literally sort of be as imaginative as possible and it all be nailed down just because of where it was taking place.
Did you have to leave and come back to get the idea?
I did. I left New York in 2008 for a year, and because I lost my apartment and just bottomed out, right? New York City, a New York City tale, right? And I moved back to D.C. and was there for a year. And it was then that I thought about, everything became much more clear. Like, Brooklyn became much more vivid when I wasn't in it, right? Like, I could sort of see everything a lot differently, and I could smell things and hear things differently because I wasn't in it every day. I could step away and look at it for what it is and hold it up against something else. And so when I got back to Brooklyn a year later, it had shifted a lot, of course. Like, things change really fast here. But it hit me really hard and became really, really obvious how alive my neighborhood specifically was.
That year was the year that everything happened in Brooklyn, actually.
2008.
Sorry.
Was it?
Yeah, 2008. You missed it all.
I missed everything. And then I came back and it was over. The wave had passed.
Mark, I know there's a character in one of your stories who goes to visit his friend at Brandeis, and he's still commuting to City College, and he's really struck by the contrast of life in college and that he's missing out on and life in his own hometown. And I wondered a little bit in writing this book if you had to leave Marine Park to see it more clearly, or if that was part of what made you want to write about it.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think that's almost a... You know, people, it's every writer, every good writer has a different good quote about that. Like, there's the AS Byatt, you know, you can only write about summer on a winter's day or something like that. And it kind of makes me think of this book of working on my novel. It's the collection of tweets. Do you guys know this? It's sort of like an art. It's a book that is just a collection of people's tweets, and it's them tweeting, sorry, gotta go, working on my novel. And sort of the center of the book is that, well, you're not working on your novel if you're tweeting about it. So whenever you're writing, you have to be not in the place that you're writing about. You know, that sort of writing is an act of separation and distancing. And I think that, especially when you're writing about a place like Brooklyn, that becomes even clearer when you're doing, you know, if you're writing about Brooklyn, you have to be kind of away from it in some way.
I think Evan would dispute that with some of the writers who you chronicle who write about Brooklyn while being in it.
That's true. I mean, many of them did, but I don't think I would dispute it directly, but I would say that, like, I like what you said about there's always an act of distancing in writing. I mean, even if you remain in Brooklyn...
Sort of psychic distance.
Yes, and literal physical distance. You know, you're in a room alone, right? I do think that, you know, as we all know now, it's sort of a cliche, there are tons of writers in Brooklyn now. And I think, you know... It's easy to be sort of cynical about that, like it's an old story, and it's like, oh, you can't walk down the block without running into a writer. But I think, you know, that's, I don't think that's such a bad thing. And I think what people, you know, people derive a lot from that in their lives, that they have people in their lives who understand what they're trying to do and who, you know, don't treat it as some bizarre hobby that you might write a work of fiction, and, you know, who can kind of, you can go to consult about this chapter that isn't working, things like that. Like, to me, that's community, and it's not something to be just kind of dismissed. So I think there is some benefit to kind of being where it seems to be, you know, being where it's at.
One thing that I liked about your book also is you describe writers who had nothing in common, who are sort of orbiting the same areas, whether it's Marianne Moore or Henry Miller, kind of wandering in and out of the same parks, but not interacting with each other at all, not taking inspiration from each other at all, and having completely different approaches to their writing, or ideas about what they were trying to do creatively.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes I kept kind of coming back to this image while I was working on the book of, like, kind of overlays on a map where each of these writers had a kind of internal map of the place that was their own, but they all kind of accrete on one map. And so I would be reading and kind of come back to the same places being described over the years, and you could kind of read the change in the place through that, but you could also read the change in the people, you know, that they were seeing through different eyes, and those were some good moments in researching the book.
Jason, I wanted to ask you about how Bed-Stuy influences your characters, how it rubs off on them, and in particular in Ali, he's very much a product of his neighborhood, in that he's this good kid who has a very easy time getting into trouble or being close to trouble. And maybe you can just talk a little bit about that, how the neighborhood shaped him as a person.
I think, you know, I always talk about codes, right? The sort of the term codes and social coding. And what I mean by that is that in certain neighborhoods, and actually in all neighborhoods, there are social codes that everyone sort of knows, whether they're spoken or unspoken, we all sort of know, right? If I'm in some neighborhoods, you turn your music down, right? If I'm in a car, right? But if I'm in my neighborhood, you turn your music up when you're in a car, right? It just sort of depends on what the neighborhood psyche is. And so I think that in this particular story, the young people in the story are influenced simply by the codes of the community. For instance, loyalty, right? In Bed-Stuy and in most communities of color all around the country, right? Loyalty is one of those strange, really, really weird things, because people really hold dear to it almost to a fault. People are as loyal as people really sort of cling to each other and cleave to each other. If I'm your friend, I'm your friend. If you're my brother, you're my brother. Even when you're wrong, I'm going down with you, which we all know is oftentimes a terrible, terrible thing. But that's sort of what the community codes are oftentimes. Whether we understand them or not, that's just the way it goes. Family's a big deal. In most of these communities, family is all you really have. And what that family looks like isn't always a nuclear family. It isn't always sort of dad at home and so forth and so on, even though it also isn't always dad's not home. And it isn't always, or it's not always dad is home or dad's not home and dad's not around. Sometimes it's dad's not home and dad's around, right? Or dad loves me, he just doesn't live here. Or, you know, mom's not around and dad's here. Or big brother's taking care of me. All these different sort of dynamics, I think, in these communities are what sort of strengthen these kids in this way and help and have them act the way they do, right? They are a little older than they seem, yet they're still kids. And they look to each other as family. They look to each other for loyalty. They try to trust each other. They want to protect each other. It's all about sort of maintaining a particular unit while moving throughout this sort of neighborhood, whether you're on the good side or the bad side or on this street or that street. We're moving as a unit at all times. And that is a very sort of, not just a Bed-Stuy thing, but just I grew up in a black neighborhood in D.C. It's just from what I know, and I lived in Detroit. I mean, communities of color in general, that's typically how they operate, for whatever reason.
Elena, that reminds me of your little family unit in Brighton Beach, and they have a kind of code, but it's very much their own little unit, and they kind of look after each other very intensely, and they are a world unto themselves. I almost felt like there's their house, and then everyone else is a little bit in the backdrop in the neighborhood. I mean, how does that square with your own experience?
Well, I guess there's a lot of similarity between Russian people and, you know, black people.
Jason's like, no.
Yeah, you're like, also, the music is very loud, but that to me is just painful. I just please turn the music down in the car. But the family is the, like, I think my family in particular is just like this, you know, intense clan. It's like, it's very, very intense. But I think that that's also generally immigrants, you know, any sort of immigrant community, whether it's Russian, Jewish, Chinese, I mean, anything, you come and then you just, you hole up in your apartment, you know, usually it's too many people and too small of an apartment, and you just let your neuroses, like, you know, entangle you in the craziest, you know, possible little thing in the world. Which is like love mixed with every other emotion in the world. So that's, yeah, I feel like I understand that.
And, I mean, it's the case for some folks in your story, too. I mean, there's one particular story, I don't remember the title, about this husband and wife couple who are almost straight out of a mafia movie.
Vincent Aurora.
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's totally true that all these, this is one of the things about Brooklyn, I guess, is that there's these neighborhoods that have these extremely strong characters, characters of the neighborhoods, not people characters, and the sad bit is that often these are racial divides, and even more often those divides aren't really bridged, which is, in a lot of ways, the case is in all three of these neighborhoods, really, but then there are sort of the moments where those divides do get bridged, and that's kind of where the fiction comes in, I guess, and also just general good things for the world when everyone kind of merges a little bit more. Yeah, I mean, it's an open question. I mean, I guess it's, honestly, it's probably happening in Bed-Stuy before it's happening in Marine Park and Brighton Beach.
I'm purposely moving to Marine Park. Like, you want to start the process?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Start working that out. You know?
But, like, not on your fixed gear.
Did you feel trapped in any way by the label Brooklyn Writer, or by how unique your neighborhoods are, that some way imposed a kind of restriction on what was expected of the story, or what your characters could or couldn't do? And this is really an open question for anyone.
Yes. Yes. And it's weird because it's such a bittersweet thing for me, because I, you know, there's nothing more that I want to do than to tell the stories of the kids in my neighborhood. But the hard part about that is when I began to write the book, I needed to make sure that I was as honest as possible and to really show them for who they were on all fronts, and to write the book in their tongue. And the hard part about writing a book in the tongue of a teenager is that you run the risk of turning them into caricatures if you're not careful. And so that was the hardest part, like battling sort of this notion of like, all right, I want to make sure that I'm nailing the language. I want to make sure that I'm really capturing the way they speak without turning them into jokes. And having critics say, like, oh, he's irresponsible with his writing, all the crap that, I mean, I know you're a book reviewer, so not you.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but, you know, like, just, you know, so that was the hard part. I felt a bit of constraint when it came to that part.
Well, I think that it's the writer's job to feel limited by, you know, everything. So feel limited by the neighborhood, feel limited by your identity. You know, in my case, it would be Russian, it would be Jewish, it would be, you know, female. So feel limited by it all. I in no way did I set out to, you know, give the voice to Brighton Beach, give the voice to all of the, you know, crazy people in my neighborhood. I mean, that somebody should probably do that, but that's definitely not me. There's no possible way that I could do that. So And I have no problem showing caricatures. That's another thing that I've heard, that every character of mine seems to be a caricature.
You're happy with that?
I'm fine with that. Yeah, I'm not trying.
They're memorable.
I'm not trying to, paint those paintings where everything is exactly realistic and a vase looks exactly like a vase looks.
I mean, working in short fiction as you have been, Mark, you can kind of break that rule. You can set a story on Mars. You can set a story, in another era entirely.
That's true.
You do.
That's one of my favorite things about short stories as opposed to novels, that you do have that freedom to sort of go a little bit farther abroad. And it's kind of interesting, one of the things that Evan has in his book about the fact that there is no Brooklyn school of writing, which there isn't, but in some ways you could make a kind of sociological argument to say that there's, every writer is a Brooklyn writer in some respects, because just the way that the industry is kind of centered around Brooklyn, and there's so many Brooklyn editors and writers and copy editors and publicity people. So there's, you could say that it's had its effect far, much more.
Mark,
than,
I live in Queens.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, it's Brooklyn, using Brooklyn as an adjective, really, not even a.
As the first suburb, as the first place where people were just outside. Evan, is there one writer of all the writers you profile who you think was most psychically affected by Brooklyn? I mean, I wanted to maybe offer up William Styron. You and I were talking about that earlier. But I don't know if there's anyone else who came to this city and was just struck by it, and struck by the borough in particular, and changed by it.
I'm not sure that this is my final answer, but I like talking about L.J. Davis, who's probably like one of the least known writers that I write about. But he wrote this brilliant book called A Meaningful Life. It's extremely funny, extremely like rude and politically incorrect, published in 1971, and it's about, it is quite, there are strong autobiographical elements, and I think he was struck by it as a newcomer. He was part of the kind of early gentrifiers, and he moved into a neighborhood that was really in hard times at the time. It was like, so this is in the 60s, and it was Clinton Hill, sort of on the border of Bed-Stuy. And he's a white guy. He's surrounded by people who are not white, and it's a sort of bizarre social experiment that's going on, and like there are other people like him in the neighborhood, but not many. And there's, there's a lot of like friction, and it's kind of uncomfortable at times. But
it's an era of Paula Fox, also, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And his son became good friends with Jonathan Lethem, right?
Yes. And Lethem wrote the introduction to the book, but when it was republished, and it was sort of a success, it's so clear that that book doesn't exist without its setting. I mean, it really is like a kind of great document of its time and place.
Could have only been set there.
Right.
And sort of before, like Lethem's book, you have the benefit of being able to look back over sort of what happened since the 70s, but that book doesn't, right? It's sort of just its own time.
Right. That was interesting for me to think about. I mean, both him and Paula Fox wrote this book, Desperate Characters, that I discuss about the same time, that it was a much different place, and it was really on the cusp, and they didn't know what the outcome would be. I mean, they would be, the authors at that time would be absolutely shocked about what we're seeing in this atrium. I mean, it would just blow their minds.
If each of you could have written a different book about Brooklyn, someone else's book that's already out there, what would it be and why? So basically asking for recommendations for everyone. Whose book do you wish you'd written?
I wish I wrote The Power Broker.
There. That's a good answer.
I'm not really a fiction writer, so I feel like that's a good answer. I'm going to go with that.
Can I do a movie, actually?
Sure.
I would love if I had made Do the Right Thing, honestly, the Spike Lee movie, because it's such a, you know, say what you will about its politics or anything like that, but it's such a perfect description of a neighborhood, no matter which neighborhood it is. Maybe it's more Fort Greene than Bed-Stuy, but it's... Yeah, I think it's a perfect movie, and I love a lot of Spike Lee's movies, but that you can sort of see him going towards that in a lot of other movies, and that one's kind of perfect.
Sorry. Do you want?
Did you ask what was it called? Oh, he picked a movie. He picked Do the Right Thing. Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing.
Which is set in Bed-Stuy, I guess. I mean, what's the street? I forget the street name, but yeah.
Elena, you look like you had an answer.
Yeah, well, I have to stick with, like, Brighton Beach, Coney Island. And whenever I think of, like, what growing up there was like, I always think that it was, like, Requiem for a Dream, which is, I think, a really great movie, really fun movie. I just like to watch it a few times a week. but it's also a really great book by... Hubert Selby Jr. Is that his name? Oh my God, is that, yeah. That is okay. Yeah. Anyway, so the book is, I mean, the movie is basically just an exact transcription of the book, and the book is fantastic. So I think it was like that mixed with Brighton Beach Memoirs, which is less good, but, you know, schmaltzy in the right way. So it would be like a mushing of those two.
For me, it's tough because most of my favorite writers are actually from Harlem, funny enough. But if I had to pick, so I pick out of that pool, unfortunately, because I mean, most of my writers that influenced me are from Harlem. So I would probably
you can pick a Harlem writer.
We can
make an exception.
So I would probably go with John A. Williams, who's a very, very unfortunately unknown writer, who wrote a book called Sons of Darkness, Sons of Light. It was written in the 60s, about the 70s in Harlem, centered around police brutality in Harlem and a black professor who hires an Italian like mob boss to hire a Russian hitman to kill a crooked cop. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I mean, what do you do if a black guy pays a white guy to kill a white guy in the 70s? It's a brilliant, brilliant story. I would imagine everybody should read that book. It's fantastic.
Where is your next book going to be set?
My next book isn't. It comes out in like 5 months, and it's set in Brooklyn again. You know.
I have an ebook, a like 19,000 word sort of magazine story meets book, a reported story that is set in Detroit about a notorious teenage cocaine dealer from the 1980s who was also an informant. So that's coming soon to a theater near you. I didn't know you had some Detroit roots. We got to talk about that.
I'd like to say that it's set on Mars, but it's not. It's probably a mix of general Brooklyn, the Upper West Side, which is where I currently live, and maybe Russia. So boring.
I think I'm just going to go through Brooklyn and name a lot of books with the names of neighborhoods. So next is, you know...
Sheepshead Bay.
No, I'm definitely not going to do that. I promise I'm not going to do that. I'd like to write sort of elsewhere, places other than Brooklyn, but I'm sure that Brooklyn will always have a part in whatever I'm writing.
You don't know yet?
No, yeah, no. My editor is out there somewhere, and she's asking the same question. She's like, "Where? What's that?" Or she's saying, "No, don't, not Brooklyn, definitely not Brooklyn." So yeah, no, still sort of working.
We'll open up to audience questions pretty soon, but I wanted to ask you guys also if there is any particular scene or moment that you weren't able to get into your book that is still so iconic to the neighborhood. So something quirky about the neighborhood that you work on that just didn't quite fit in your book, that really shares something of the essence of it? Or is it a tough question because if it's any good material, you put it in there?
I think I wish I'd gotten something in about the Rockaways and Fort Tilden, which are kind of sister beaches and neighborhoods to Marine Park.
And there's some characters in your book who hang out with characters in the Rockaways.
Right. It's sort of vaguely in there. But I think Fort Tilden in particular, which is kind of a neighborhood that has changed, or, you know, a beach, a place that has changed so much recently, which would have been sort of an interesting contrast to Marine Park, which kind of has been in the stasis, I guess.
For me, it's hard to say because I also write stories, and it seems like absolutely every possible, Brighton Beach piece of color, like, I try to cram into one of my stories. There are lots of beach interactions that I've had with older women in totally
more.
Inappropriate bathing suits that... Yeah.
That's it?
I don't think I should go further.
I don't know. I mean, there were some scenes edited out, just different conversations amongst the teenagers talking that were really funny. You know, just there's a lot of stuff that didn't make the book that was just really funny teenager conversational stuff. The stuff that you all probably see and hear all the time, right? On the subway, right? A lot of those conversations we had to just cut out for pacing purposes. But other than that, no, not really.
I don't know if that one really applies to me.
Yeah, that's a tough one for you.
What writer did you cut from the book?
Well, I think we can open it up to audience questions now. So Brenda's got the microphone there. And if anyone's got any questions they want to start out with. Here we go.
Okay, I'm a native Brooklynite, not a writer, possibly something even rarer, a native Brooklynite book editor. And I grew up in Bay Ridge, and I was hoping to get a name out of a really great writer from Bay Ridge who I keep on hoping that the Brooklyn Literary Renaissance will raise his profile, and it hasn't yet. His name is Gilbert Sorrentino. And you write about him en passant, more in respect to his friend, Hubert Selby Jr., and my friend and colleague at Random House, Mark Giussano, I have infected him with the Sorrentino virus. But the book, the particular book that's just soaked in the details of Bay Ridge from like 39 to 52 is Steelwork. But many of his other books are very, very particular to Bay Ridge, and I know every bar and a candy store that's in there.
I hope you write about this.
I have in book forum. It didn't do any good. would both of you gentlemen please testify as to the importance of Gilbert Sorrentino in the Brooklyn Renaissance?
A bit about him, and one of the things I know also is that he was a very influential teacher of writing. He taught, I believe, at Stanford? Yes. And, the people you see far and wide who cite him as an influence, as a teacher, is really something. And he was a very, at times, experimental writer, and I think that kind of influence from teaching, you can kind of read it down the generations, and I always think that's worth a lot. But you sound like you know more than me.
If there, correct me if I have this name of the story wrong, but When the Moon in Its Flight, is that what it's called? The Moon in Its Flight. That's if you read one Gilbert Sorrentino after you leave here, read that one. It's fantastic.
What about Little Casino? Is that the title?
Little Casino is also.
That's the one that I love that one. Yeah, that's good.
Thank you.
We have another.
Any other questions?
Hi. It's actually more of an observation. I am a native Brooklynite, and I've just actually finished writing about life in Bay Ridge. I was amazed you mentioned, but the focus of it is when my family, I'm the firstborn, we first moved to 8th Avenue and 52nd Street in 1943. So the time frame runs from 1943, November, to the time when we actually moved from there, November of 1958. So it encompasses an enormous amount of change within a neighborhood that was extremely tight-knit. All my friends were of one parentage, one heritage. I had friends who were all Italian, all Norwegian, all Irish. And when in school I was asked to say, introduce myself, I would say, I am English, French, Italian, Greek, and Irish. So I was an anomaly within my friends' worlds. But what struck me in listening to all of you is that you have each lived and expressed outward what your experiences were about Brooklyn. I have a strong memory of life then, and I describe the shops, and I describe the life, and it takes me through all of my grade school experiences. I went to PS 94 in a school that sat on top of the ridge of Bay Ridge, and we looked out. If I was in a classroom that looked over the harbor, everything would stop when the big liners came in. And you would hear them before you knew they were coming, because this huge, humanly unutterable sound would just fill the entire neighborhood, announcing that the Queen Mary or the Queen Elizabeth was approaching. And you know, everything stopped. Everything stopped. And so my education was as much from the neighborhood as it was from the teachers themselves. And so this writing, and this is what Brooklyn does. Okay. Brooklyn does this.
I have another question.
Yeah.
It's
Thank
a form
you.
Of education in itself. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you. I saw another hand back there.
I'm not supposed to relinquish this mic.
Excuse me. I'm just wondering, since we were talking about getting distance from your neighborhoods, where each of you live now? No street addresses or anything, just general.
Where do you all live now?
Fort Greene.
I'm in Bed-Stuy.
The Upper West Side.
I'm in Cobble Hill. That was a real authenticity question. It was like, did you guys abandon?
You can't continue to write about it if you still live there.
Right.
So we already established that. So you're in the clear.
Hi, I'm from Coney Island, Brighton Beach area myself, and growing up there, I couldn't wait to get away from it. I totally could understand. As I've grown older, I am so drawn back to it, and I go there, and it's like I see ghosts of my past, and it's beautiful. And the thing about being from Brooklyn is like it's in your genes, you know, like it's like a fierce pride and also a sort of disdain at the same time. Not disdain, that's the wrong word, but sort of like a wound, like you said, in some way. But I wonder, my question to you is, how do you ever think about how you might perceive your Marine Park, for example, and Bed-Stuy, as you grow older, I mean, your relationship to the place you grew up in changes as you grow. And I wonder if it's changed for you, or you think that you might think about that in the future.
That's a great question. I mean, is the relationship with the neighborhoods you describe very contingent on the time of life you are in now and that you are in when you most deeply experience them? Or how's that going to change with time?
I think also just writing about a place changes the way that you feel about it. Like that physics principle about knowing something about a particle or whatever, it moves it, you know, that you sort of have these ideas about a place that you formulated, and once you formulated them, you're kind of stuck in that formulation, which is kind of sad, and I don't want to be sort of stuck with the way I see Marine Park when I was writing this book. So I hope that it changes, and I think that the more you write, and if you keep writing about a place, it definitely changes.
Well, I agree that Brighton Beach and Coney Island, for some reason, is very ghostly, or even when I was younger, it always struck me as very ghostly. Also, I guess if you live there year-round and, you know, in the summer, everybody comes to the beach, to the park, and then for the whole rest of the year, it's just, you know, like the boardwalk, like slick with the rain, or, you know, the Luna Park shut down. So there's that ghostly element that's just inlaid into that terrain. But I kind of wish that I had this thing where, you know, I wanted to leave Brighton Beach and then I spent 20 years away and then I was drawn back to it. That's sort of like the dream scenario. Instead, I have it that in every single day, where it's just every day it's like, I need to get out of here. And then it's just like right away, no, I need to go back. And so that replays it with great intensity all the time. I can't imagine that changing. Like, I can't imagine not feeling drawn back and then trapped and then needing to get out.
I think for me, it'll be sort of the opposite. I think, you know, when I'm 40 or 50 or 60, for that matter, I think the nostalgia will be driving me crazy, right, about Bed-Stuy. I think someone in my neighborhood who read the book came to me and said, hey, man, I really appreciate you just documenting the way Bed-Stuy is now, right? Because Bed-Stuy won't be this way in 10 years, right? Whether it's better or worse is left up to whoever's opinion, but it won't be the same. And so I think for me, I think as I grow older, my affinity for Bed-Stuy and sort of this strange loyalist mentality I have for Bed-Stuy gets thicker, only because I'm sort of grasping at what it was.
That sounds like a nice remark to get. I would like that one. Thank you for getting down what the neighborhood is.
I mean, I noticed, Evan, in looking for interviews of these writers back in the day talking about Brooklyn, sometimes they wrote letters about living in Brooklyn, sometimes they wrote, you know, diary entries or essays about living in Brooklyn, but they didn't come on the radio and talk about living in Brooklyn very much. It was just a backdrop of their life. And even when there was a little bit of a literary scene, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, it was not something that was on the forefront of people's minds in the same way, and only looking back does it become such a defining characteristic of them.
Yeah, that's true. As I was saying before, there's several writers covered in the book who I think wanted nothing more than to get out of Brooklyn, where they had grown up, and often that meant kind of crossing into Manhattan, into what they considered a more sophisticated and urbane world. But so many of them returned to Brooklyn, if not literally, then in their work, and it became some of their best work, I think, that it had. And that may just have to do with, you know, the childhood as the seat of the imagination, partly. But Malamud is a good example of that. Alfred Kazin. So, I don't know.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Hi. I just want to say given that we're in this neighborhood near Crown Heights, if any of you have read Chaim Potok, I don't know if you, in the New York school systems, they must change their reading lists over the years, but I remember my daughter reading it in middle school, and I actually hadn't read it yet till then, so I read it later in life. But I'm just wondering if he's still read or if you're looking forward to reading him. And I just want to say thank you for your Brooklyn humor.
I think the school system's reading lists have not changed at all. I definitely read that in middle school, for sure.
The Chosen?
Yeah, I read
definitely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sure it's still read.
I think I saw another question.
All right.
I'll hold the mic.
All right, thanks. I just thought it would be easier. And anyway, this is sort of an essay question, which I guess is appropriate for writers, meaning I have an idea that's been, a thought that's been on my mind since I've been sitting here that I want to share, and you all can react to it. When I read the title of this event and the little blurb that described it, what came to my mind immediately, and this is not the only interpretation or necessarily the best interpretation, but that what came to my mind was that this broad concept, the theme of this evening of the contemporary Brooklyn literary scene, could be seen as a facet of the broader phenomenon of what some would call the Manhattanization of Brooklyn. Different people have different points of view on this, and I'm not saying one is right or wrong, but I'm saying that perception of that phenomenon does exist. As an acquaintance of mine put it to me recently, said that Brooklyn is the Manhattan of the 21st century, and I slightly disagreed with that statement. I said it's not the Manhattan of the 21st century. It's that the 21st century may be the age of Brooklyn. Okay. I'm going somewhere with it. Just hold.
Okay.
No, I'm getting there. Just a moment. Okay. So keeping with that theme of, if you think of it that way, that the 21st century might be the age of Brooklyn, in the way that the 19th or 20th centuries were the age of Manhattan, we're coming up on the centenary of one of the great phenomenon of the Manhattan literary scene, which is the round table at the Algonquin Hotel in the 1920s. And it occurs to me that in this era, there doesn't, that sort of exchange that happened during those years in that location tends not to happen in a single physical place anymore. It tends to happen in the digital world. I do have a question. My question is, my question is, am I missing something? Is there a, maybe there's more than one sort of central physical location that could be like in the 20-teens and 20s, what the Algonquin was in Manhattan in the late 19-teens and 20s.
So where would the heart, I think, where would the physical heart of literary Brooklyn be?
Well,
is there one?
You know, isn't it in the Brooklyn's magazines, I guess, in some ways, you know, N plus one.
No.
And,
no. Oh, no, that's not what I meant. I would think it's
not
in the bars. Like, there has to be alcohol involved, right?
Yeah, there's definitely alcohol mixes with magazines, I think. But
I saw like the actual magazine.
I think that it's true, though, that it's more dispersed now. That's a function of a different era, that you could have everything in the same place with so few people, and a lot of voices were excluded, obviously, in that round table.
It's weird, though. I think it'd be really hard to nail down. I mean, it's, times have changed so much, it'd be really hard, because we don't necessarily always feel the need to do that anymore, like they did back when they were meeting at the Algonquin. I will say, though, there are certain hubs in the city that I find are always packed with writers. Like, and it's not in Brooklyn. That's the only thing, not in Brooklyn. But like, you know, like if you go down to, even though all the writers do live in Brooklyn, but if you go to like, you know, like McNally Jackson Bookstore, right, in Soho. If you go down there and you go in there, everyone is just in there. Like, so many writers are just in that particular bookstore. And I don't know what it is. I don't know why it's that store, but writers that I admire are just hanging out in that bookstore all the time, just looking around or just talking about what they're working on. Or the guy who works there, I mean, I don't know if you got Chris Jackson, who's an editor. He, you know, he co-owns the spot, right? So everybody's just there, sort of hanging out. And so, you know, that's a spot. But I don't know any spots in Brooklyn. I don't know if that's...
I guess we're not invited, maybe.
Or maybe we're not invited. Or even maybe the spots, it may be happening. I just think it may be small. It might be like pockets. You know, it may not be some... I mean, who's to say who the writers are of today and who gets called to that meeting, you know? It's like, I don't...
I'm wondering if it's in Evan's living room because he's written a book about Brooklyn. His wife has written about a book about a writer in Brooklyn, Adele Waldman, the wife of Nathaniel P. So is it just in your house?
No.
Where do you go hang out Nothing with your writing friends?
Because I also wouldn't want to go to one of these meetings and it's like lame. That's the other thing. It's like writers, listen, let's not pretend. I mean, you know, so many people are just, I don't want to go somewhere to hear somebody else basically give me the rigmarole of how awesome they are. I'm not really interested in that, right? So it's like, depends on who's there, right? Like, if you're having this meeting and you invite me, I'm going to be like, I'll just call my friends over to my house and we'll just spit a bottle of whiskey and talk about it in there, you know? And then record it and put it on YouTube so everyone can see.
We've got just a few more questions and one...
Yeah, I grew up in Marine Park a couple blocks from where you did, about 50 years earlier. One of the things I noticed that was constant, though, with all the changes, is that we refer to Manhattan as the city. That was in your book, and it was in my life. And my daughter now tells me in Staten Island, we refer Staten Island as Manhattan as the city. I don't know of any other place where they live in the city and refer to the city as the city, as if it was somewhere else. So I don't know, maybe you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's so physical. If you think of it, in Marine Park, if you're on Nostrand Avenue, and you can literally see straight down to the Freedom Tower, and, you know, you used to be able to see the Twin Towers, right? And there's similar blocks in, in Fort Greene, that it's like Navy Street or whatever, where there's like literally places where you can just see the city kind of rise up like Oz or something. So it's hard not to think of it as anything but a separate place.
And I think I like it that way. You know, because even in Bed-Stuy, everybody refers to Manhattan as the city. You know, it's like if you're going into Manhattan, you still say, are you going into the city? And I think there's a sense of solace about not living in the city. Like, even though we all are in the city, it's better. It feels good to know. Like, when I'm in Manhattan and I cross the bridge, even on my bicycle or on the subway or in a car, there's a sense of home. There's a warmth that sort of happens. Even in the hustle and bustle of Brooklyn, there's still like, this is awesome. Like, it was good not having. I mean, as much as I hated trying to catch a yellow cab home, it was also awesome that there were no yellow cabs in my neighborhood, right? It was like, oh, God, no yellow cabs. Thank God I can just hang out in my neighborhood without the yellow cab thing, right? And now that, of course, has changed, too. But, you know, it's like, I don't know. I like the separation.
One last question.
Hello. I'm actually on assignment writing a portfolio on a specific neighborhood, and I've actually chosen Bensonhurst as the arc. Would you be able to offer me any kind of insight on the gentrification, the demographic and cultural changes over time?
Bensonhurst, where my family is sort of from, half of it, I guess, although they got the hell out of there a long time ago. But, yeah, I mean... I think that's one neighborhood that's really, it's one of the few non-sort of gentrifying neighborhoods or non-Manhattan Brooklyn neighborhoods that are changing rapidly and ethnically too. I guess it's sort of a much more Asian influenced community now than it has been in a long time. But yeah, that's a great story.
Before we go, I was hoping you could all describe a perfect fall day in your neighborhood. And Evan, this could be Fort Greene. What it looks like outside on the street.
Somebody else go first.
I guess for mine, it would be Marine Park, the park itself, which is a really great park. And in the fall, it's sort of totally taken over by soccer teams and football teams. They have ASO soccer, which have all these really colorful jerseys. So it's kind of the jerseys match the trees, and it's very pretty. Although it takes a while to get out there.
For me, the first thing that I thought of when you said that is Yom Kippur. Because on that day in Brighton Beach, all the Russian Jews who are in no way religious at all, that's the one day that where you prove that you're a Jew. So you have to fast. You know, that's the one thing that we know about the Jewish religion, that you fast on this one day, and we love food. So not eating until the evening is very, very, very difficult, and you have to show to everybody, you know, how hard it is for you. So you put on, everybody puts on their most, like, glorious, you know, dresses and gowns and furs, and you go outside after you go, I guess, to synagogue in the morning. It's the one day when you go to the synagogue, and you parade down the boardwalk, and usually it's like incredible weather. It's, you know, like blue sky, and there's the crisp air, and, you know, you're in your best clothes, and you just meet everybody that you know on the boardwalk, and you complain about how you're about to die because you haven't eaten since last night. And that's, I think that's the best fall day.
I guess the best fall day for me would look a lot like today, like how today was. Because every day is like that, you know, as in that particular part of Bed-Stuy, like the park and the old men in the park, they're there every day. Every day. The old men are in the park. The one guy has got his car door open, blasting the music, and they're yelling at each other, and they're playing chess. Some are playing, like, speed chess, and they're really good, and it's really intense, and there are kids riding their bicycles around the old men. And they're talking about all sorts of crazy stuff, from conspiracy theories and politics and women and men and, you know, all kinds of just barbershop talk, you know, but outside at this park playing chess. To me, it's the most fascinating sense of camaraderie and community to see it, because it doesn't always make sense and it doesn't always seem very nice, but it's very much so a love thing in this park.
I think Jason's is a good answer to end on.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for coming. Everyone's book, Evan Hughes is the author of Literary Brooklyn. Jason Reynolds is the author of When I Was the Greatest. Yelena Tereskaya is the author of Panic in the Suitcase. Mark Chisano's book is called Marine Park Stories. Everyone's book is available at the Brooklyn Museum store. And thank you very much to the museum for hosting us, and to WNYC for putting on this event. Special thanks to Brenda Williams-Butts and Alex Murray and George Wellington at WNYC, who all helped put this together tonight. And have a perfect fall night, everyone.